Welcome to Culinary Convo. I am your host, Devin Ream. The coffee is poured and your spot at the table is open. I've got my mise en place, and if your mind is open, let us begin. Hey, everybody. Welcome to A Plate in Time 1900. We've landed. We have our cat with us. Oh, wrong thumb. I'm still trying to figure out how to do the camera stuff. Our cat. He came with us, and also my wife came with me. Yay!
Hi.
Yeah,
I'm like really self-conscious right now, so
yeah, I am a little. I don't know if I've got stuff on my shirt, but my beard and my mic cover it.
Well, it's my first time since you've started this, so
yeah, you're on the new format.
Yeah,
of A Plate in Time. Yeah.
We're in
combo.
My Led Zeppelin shirt, trying to be cool.
Yeah, trying to be hip with the youngsters.
No. Half of them probably don't know who it is.
They don't know these people.
Yeah. Just self-conscious.
You got your Canadian flag.
I do. I'm not Canadian,
right,
but
right.
I love Canada.
Yeah, and you've got a support cat. So
yeah, see in the corner, that's my leg, and
he's
squeaking.
He already know. Oh, here he goes. Oh man, sorry listeners, if you're just listening, we've got a cat that is just too rambunctious.
But just squeaked.
Yeah, he squeaks a lot. He's a squeaker.
Yeah.
But yeah, Plate in Time 1900. What are you thinking? 1900, turn of the century, huh?
I mean, I'm not, like, I don't know. Not as excited as maybe other times.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this is kind of like the tail end of times that don't interest me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Everything before 1800, what a bore. You know, the 1899 and back. Boring.
I don't know. I don't care about it as much, you know.
Oh my God.
Stop.
Okay.
Compared to, you know, like the 1910s, 20s, I think that's when it starts to get interesting.
Yeah.
Because there's, you know, the suffrage movement. There's
cars.
World War I. There's cars. There's
airplanes.
You know. We're starting to get more into the Roaring Twenties, Art Deco, all that fun stuff.
Right,
so.
More design-oriented type things, right?
Maybe.
That's helpful.
Yeah. I mean, there were some interesting, like, historical things, too.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Downton Abbey.
Right.
That's a vibe.
It was a whole vibe.
That show made me interested in 1910s onward.
Yeah.
But, you know, right now we're at the very tail end.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we're in a period of time that I think, whether you're in American schools or what have you, it's really not talked about. You've got the Industrial Revolution, which was pre-1900. And then, like you said, it's kind of like World War I, but that was like 14, 15 years for the U.S. That was not, you know, so it's like, what happened before then?
17.
Right. 17 well, years. We entered in 1914, right?
The U.S. did not.
I thought we did. 1914.
We entered near the tail end, kind of like World War II. Mm-hmm. We entered 1917 and then it ended the next year.
Oh, right. Yeah. We were only in it for like a year. Yeah. But the whole war.
This
anyway,
is not
it was a
historical podcast. It's about the food.
Historically.
The historical food, not the historical
anyway,
nature.
Off of that tangent, onto a new one. So basically, what I know about 1900 is, like I said, it's just not talked about. Like, it's almost like if you ask anybody what happened between 1900 and 1910, it's like that guy that's on the dime was president. Like, that's all I know. Or the nickel. Which one has Woodrow Wilson? He's not on anything, I don't think.
I haven't used change
Man,
in
I'm
so
awful.
Long.
I am awful at history. Why do I have this podcast? Anyways, Yeah, Plate and Time, 1900. First up from lovefood.com, their most popular recipes from every decade, from 1900 to today. Yeah, chicken pudding.
Mm.
Yeah.
Not like chocolate pudding.
No, this is not at all.
I'm guessing this is like the English pudding.
Yeah, yeah. There's our other cat. Yeah. Anyways, watch on YouTube, folks. Watch on YouTube. Yeah. You can see the cats.
You see the chicken pudding.
It's amazing.
Frames.
Anyway, the chicken pudding, it looks like somebody made a very bad version of mac and cheese. That's what it looks like to me.
It looks like soup when it's in the fridge.
Oh, yeah.
Like it's congealed, yeah. And it's just a thick blob.
Yeah.
That's what it looks like to me.
Let's talk about this savory blob.
Okay.
Particularly loved in Virginia, a savory recipe called chicken pudding was popular at the start of the 20th century. Imagine the textures of quiche and cake combined, and it's similar to this dish of chicken pieces baked in batter with herbs. Imagine it covered in gravy, and it still sounds strangely appetizing.
It does. You know what?
Yeah.
They're right.
It's almost like we don't want to make chicken pot pie where mm-hmm. you have crusts.
Or like
instead, we'll make it like
chicken
a cake.
And dumplings.
Yeah, but the chicken's in the dumpling.
Right.
Right? That kind of thing. This picture of it may not do it justice here, but it's in like this cast iron pot. And yeah, it just looks like it came out of the fridge. Like they're ready to reheat it. Like mm-hmm. back in 1900, they didn't have a microwave. They're like, right. Reheat it, Marge. And that is coming down the pike for old George before he goes out into the fields and harvests more wheat. And the next dish, ambrosia.
Mm.
Yeah, that's right. Ambrosia. Lovely ambrosia.
I haven't had it, but I don't plan on it.
Oh, come on. There's many a good Midwestern ambrosia recipe.
Is this not the thing that has mayo in it?
Oh, it's got all sorts of stuff. It usually doesn't have, it may have mayo. Sometimes it's got mayo. Sometimes it's got, like, salt. You know, good things. Good things in ambrosia.
Ew.
Well, let's learn about it here. In the early 20th century, ambrosia was nothing like the white, fluffy fruit salad dessert hybrid we see at potlucks today. It was light and refreshing, simply orange slices and coconut layered in a dish with sugar. However, over the years, Southern cooks have taken this recipe and given it their individual family twist, which is how ingredients such as maraschino cherries, nuts, raisins, Cool Whip, whipped cream, yogurt, and marshmallows crept in. Yeah, the raisins, I'm sorry, that was a white person thing, I think.
Probably.
Yeah, and maybe the nuts, too. I'm not sure. But whipped cream, yogurt. Like, what yogurt are you throwing in ambrosia?
I feel like yogurt is the end of what you should put in here as the...
Yeah.
Was it the emulsifier or whatever?
Right, the binder.
The binder.
Yeah, the binder.
You should not put mayo in this. I'm sorry, I don't care what anyone says, comments, whatever.
Yeah.
No.
It's a dessert, so no mayo.
It's a dessert. You should not put mayonnaise in it where the mayonnaise isn't being like blended or mixed in thoroughly. Yeah. It should not be coating fruit.
You know, the French, they do a lot of different things. And
what do the French have to do with this?
They made mayonnaise. Je crois.
I don't think they planned on this, though.
No, probably not. the picture that I have, it is the original ambrosia. You can see the coconut and the mm-hmm. oranges. So no Cool Whip here. And see, that's the thing. Me, I'm the Southern ambrosia. There's got to be Cool Whip. There's got to be marshmallows. Has to have like a pinkish tint because of the maraschino cherries. You know, some people throw fruit cocktail in there. So it's got pears. And,
I always see it as like pastel.
Yeah.
This is very... it actually looks healthy.
Because if we show up to the cookout with what is the original ambrosia, some people are going to be like, oh, is that like smoked salmon? Or is that, and we're like, yeah, no, it's, they're like, oh my gosh, is there maggots in it? We're like, no, it's original ambrosia. It's got coconut and oranges. And everybody be like, Devin, go home.
Yeah.
Just go home. Why'd you bring this?
And then
this?
Someone's like, what if I put mayo in it?
Right.
And everyone's like, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, wee. Everybody wees out.
No, yeah. They're not
Whether
French.
Whether it's for pigs or French, no. It doesn't matter. Wee. Everybody has a happy, good time.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. The next one here, you got L-E-I-T-E-S Culinaria. So it's like latesculinaria.com. It has writings of 100 years of American food. You got this century, more than any other, has been one of staggering transformation. Mm-hmm. Our population has mushroomed by almost 200 million since 1900.
Dang.
Passenger travel zoomed from the horse to the supersonic. Computers accomplish in hours what took a turn of the century factory crew days. And the foods we've eaten have taken an equally remarkable journey.
Hold on. Could you imagine someone in 1900 using a computer?
Dude, they would be.
They'd be like, what is this?
Yeah. If you showed them a cell phone, they would literally think like, oh, yeah, teleportation right around the corner. And we're like,
Well, because I don't even think refrigeration was as,
right.
You know, commercialized and mainstream yet. That was like late 1900s or 1910s or something. I don't know why that made me think that. But
what is this thin brick you gave me? We're like, oh, Francis.
There wasn't even a car yet.
Right. Yeah, so, most people didn't have cars. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So.
Is that a horseless carriage? We're like, yes, that is a horseless carriage, Frank.
It's just interesting to think about what we think is so normal right now.
Yeah.
You know, it used to not be a thing.
Right.
So.
Do you have anywhere to put my teeth in varnish? And we're like, varnish? Like, yeah, my wooden teeth. We're like, oh, man. Like, we got to get you to a dentist. I went to the dentist recently. It was a good time. Anyway, 1900 to 1909, the 20th century was rung in with contagious optimism. As early as the mid-1890s, it was dubbed the American century. We were already trying to, like, flex our muscles. Like, we're going at it. The consensus, at least at home, was that we were an unrivaled world power to whom the future belonged. Such heady times required heady meals, from the denizens of Newport, Rhode Island's multi-million dollar cottages to knockabout American laborers. Menus were meat-filled. New York City's haute restaurants offered elk, caribou, bear, moose, and even elephant to intrepid diners. Oh. Yeah. You want some elephant? We'll give you some cat right over here.
Multi-million dollar
in
the early 1900s. That's crazy.
That is a house, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
And then you've got modest eating establishments in the Midwest served mountains of the same, minus the elephant, albeit with less fanfare.
Wah.
Yeah. Some guy in Arkansas is like, you guys ain't got elephant? I got some in Rhode Island. It was great. Like, why am I here?
Yikes. That's bad.
And, like, pretty much everybody is like, dude, I don't even know what an elephant is. Like, what is that? Like, what are you talking about? And it's like, what? All of us have, like, third grade educations. How, like, we all went to work when we were 12. Like, why, you know? So, yeah, it's, but
I mean, if that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. You could run, like, the biggest company in the world, and if somebody asked, oh, what was your education? If you said anything past
nothing.
Second grade, yeah.
It could be nothing, and they'd be, like, rolling in it.
Right. Ugh. Anyway, albeit with less fanfare and a considerably lower price tag. A particular favorite along the eastern seaboard, Easton Seaboyd. Easton Seaboyd.
We've also been watching Real Housewives of New Jersey.
Oh, man.
Just because we haven't known old what seasons. Else to watch. Old right, seasons. Right. And so I think the New Jersey accent is
it's creeping
making
into
its
everything.
Way to what you do.
Yeah. I drink my coffee. I'm like, oh, this coffee. Yeah. Oh.
My girls is...
Yeah. Yeah, my girls is... They doing these things. Oh, my gosh. Oh, no. Yeah. But, yeah, particular favorite along the Eastern Seaboard was Oysters Rockefeller. I mean, duh. Baked oysters topped with savory shredded greens, although not a 20th century dish by definition. It was invented in 1899 by Jules Alciatore of Antoine's Restaurant in New Orleans. It reached its zenith in the early 1900s. Because of its rich ingredients, Alciatore chose John D. Rockefeller, one of the wealthiest men in the nation, as its namesake. Yeah. Yeah.
I like that it was off by just a year.
Right.
And they're like, oh, this isn't really 1900s, but we're going to say it is.
Well, and like, I just imagine, like, you know, they're like, this is going to be the American century. And there's like one guy at the table that's like, then why are we having Oysters Rockefeller? That was made in 1899.
Yeah.
So why are we having old food?
He was the first food critic.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah. Everybody was like, you know, Wilbur needs to shut up. You know,
Wilbur.
That was probably his name, Wilbur.
Wasn't that the pig in Babe?
Yes.
Or no, Charlotte's Web.
Yeah, Charlotte's Web.
Yeah, sorry.
That was Wilbur.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was probably him.
It probably was. Yeah. Yeah. It was just a pig at a table.
Yeah,
because everybody
a talking
thought that was okay.
pig.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
it's possible.
It was a talking pig with the help of a spider. Charlotte. Right. I mean,
fake news.
I mean, basically, you give Wilbur a pen, he ain't writing Shakespeare, okay? His little hoofs
pigs
trying to
pigs are
pretty
smart, though.
Oh, they are. They're intelligent little animals, and they grab garbage and they turn into bacon. So
I mean, who was the head in Animal Farm?
Right. He was the pig.
I'm just saying.
Oink, oink. But yeah, Alciatore also deliberately shrouded his creation in mystery. An early and successful marketing coup, he emphatically insisted that the finely minced greens were not spinach, as was commonly assumed. Later, his great-grandson, Roy F. Goost Jr.
Goost?
G-U-S-T-E, Goost, or Guste, or Gust.
Juiced?
Yeah, Juiced. Yeah, was equally tight-lipped in Antoine's Restaurant since 1840 cookbook by W.W. Norton and Company, 1980. The original recipe is still a secret that I will not divulge. If you care to concoct your version, I would tell you that the only sauce, is basically a puree of a number of green vegetables other than spinach, said Mr. Juiced. Yeah. But as Bruce Craig, a professor of history at Roosevelt University and president of the Culinary Historians of Chicago, cautions, it's important to keep in mind that this kind of food was reserved for the wealthy and the upper classes. The middle and lower classes ate far more humbly. And that's,
yeah, they couldn't have their vegetables blended up.
No, you eat them whole.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You eat them whole. You grab your, you know, you're done plowing the field for the day. You walk in and you're just like, is that a whole head of cabbage? Yeah, I'm just going to bite it. And you eat it. And you just.
I'm just noticing in that photo, is there like tomato and cheese on it?
Well, so there's cheese. I know that. I believe it's tomato and then bacon. It has bacon,
so too. This is not an original.
Right.
Version.
Right. This is not, yeah, this isn't like a ridge. Yeah, this is
bougie.
Like, right.
Bougie
right.
Oysters Rockefeller.
Oysters Rockefeller. You know?
I would eat that, though.
Oh, yeah.
I found out, what was it, a couple weeks ago. I like oysters.
Yeah.
So they're a little briny, like ocean-y. But, you know, if you put vegetables and cheese and bacon on it, then... I think anyone could like oysters.
Oh, yeah. One commodity that crossed class boundaries was sugar. Yeah.
Oh.
By 1909, America had an aching sweet tooth, with the average person consuming 65 pounds of sugar annually. The culprits? Chocolate, brownies, apple pie, devil's food cake, and baked Alaska, sweetened tea and coffee, and its newly invented decaf cousin also contributed to our ancestors' passion for sugar.
That makes me wonder how much we have now.
Right.
65 pounds is a lot.
We've taken quite a bit out, but I've always heard per, like, you know, European whatever, that Americans do have a lot of sugar. Like, whether it's in their breakfasts or whatever, we have a ton of sugar.
Yeah.
And it's like, listen, Brutus from England, okay? Leave my sugar alone.
Honestly, you these know? Are my people, though. They're like, brownies, yes.
Yeah.
Apple pie, of course.
Right.
Baked Alaska, which I haven't had, but I'd like to try one day. Mm. Opulent.
Right.
Absolutely opulent. Yeah. Rolling in sugar.
Right. And then if you were in the Midwest, you know, God forbid you had devil's food cake. You know, Patricia, you know, the Lindas out there, they would all be talking about how you had devil's food cake and not angel cake, right? Yeah, you should have had angel cake. Should have had angel
choices
cake.
Choices were made.
Yeah. It's real sad, Linda. Real sad that you're talking about my devil food cake making. Well, why are you associating with the devil? And we're like, why does Patricia sound like a man? What is going on here? And yeah, and then they're like, wasn't it Linda? And I'm like, don't name call me. If everyone's thoroughly confused, let's get back to the foodtimeline.org. You have plasmon. That's right. Plasmon.
Plasmon?
Yeah. Plasmon. It was...
Disco-do.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. It's interesting. It gets a little crazy. Our survey of historic newspapers reveals plasmon brand food products in the UK were introduced in the early 20th century. Originally marketed as a health food for invalids and children, the base product was a granulated powder composed of albumin of pure fresh milk. This flavor-free nutritional supplement was promoted to consumers as both sprinkle-on enhancement and cooking ingredient. Before long, the plasmon product line encompassed a variety of products: tea, cocoa, chocolate, and biscuits. Plasmon biscuits were mass-produced and sold in the UK, the USA, and UK-affiliated countries. They were also sold to the military for rations. Ernest Shackleton's Antarctic Nimrod Expeditions, 1907 to 1909.
Nimrod?
That's what it says right there.
Oh, capital N.
Yeah, capital N. It's somebody's name.
It's not like a description. It's a... Because that sounds like an insult.
It might be. It's the 1900s.
Isn't they that just, an insult?
Oh, yeah. People used to call other... Yeah, what a Nimrod.
Yeah.
Yeah. but yeah, they munched on plasmon biscuits across the Antarctic.
So is this an Italian brand?
It is.
Because
it is. Let me read the whole.
So this must have been like the first breakfast bar,
totally
kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. First, like energy bar.
Yeah, yeah, like protein bar or whatever. Yeah.
Plasmon was also incorporated into popular recipes. What was plasmon? Plasmon is the albumin of pure fresh milk in the form of a dry, soluble, granulated ream white powder.
Albumin?
Albumin. So it's like, I'm guessing proteins, like a protein-esque. And then in 1900, you had plasmon biscuits. Plasmon is nothing but the dry, concentrated albumin of milk, and it is said that a few plasmon biscuits will keep a soldier well-nourished for days. It is used in the German army, and the scientist Professor Virchow says that it is unrivaled. The new nutriment has solved the problem of feeding armies in the field. It has solved the starving schoolchildren question for a slice of plasmon bread. Cheap as ordinary bread with a little butter will supply a child with the nourishment of an ample meal. And farther, it has solved many of the problems of the hospital, for it gives nourishment without raising the temperature and enteric cases too important. This magic food appears in all sorts of forms, and the plasmon powder is said to be a sovereign remedy for indigestion. And that was from the Plasmon Biscuits ad of the Church Weekly in the London, UK on July 13th, 1900. Yes.
This was probably like a big deal.
Yeah.
Because you know how I think there was a show or shows, but like it was showing in the future you would eat your food
right.
as like a tablet yeah, or
as a pill.
Or, yeah.
Yeah.
So I bet they yeah. were thinking this was like that. Like it was this like, whoa. Future, dog.
That's what they
I'll
thought.
Just eat this piece of bread and I don't have to eat for 4 days. Yeah.
Well, and when I was reading basically the Wikipedia for plasmin, because I thought maybe it might have a few things. One, it does say up here, product of Italy.
Yeah.
It is an Italian thing. But the texture of it, the reason why, like, this picture is of baby biscuits, it dissolves, like, super fast in your mouth. At least the more modern ones do.
Yeah.
And so it's like you're trying to eat it, and it's like there is, like, a half second of crunch, and then your mouth just dissolves it, like, immediately.
Yeah. I will say I don't like the name.
What, plasmin?
Mm-mm.
Ooh.
It makes me think of plasma. So
oh, yeah.
I just, yeah, sorry.
Well, maybe it gives you more plasma. You'll have more plasma than the average
bear. I think there's a reason this isn't still around.
It is still around.
As popular.
Oh, it's super popular in Europe. You're showing you're American.
And now my camera, I'm embarrassed.
Honestly, the reason why I poke fun at you, I've never heard
of
this.
I've literally
stuff.
Never heard of this.
Never
ever.
Heard of this. Yeah, plasmin? I bet you anything this is something that I would say, hey, Ma, have you ever heard of plasmin? And she'd be like, oh, yes, I heard of plasmin when I was a child. And I'm like, yeah, typical. Like,
going
wow.
up the hill
yeah.
to school yeah. in the
yeah. When I had to put on my sandals, I always ate a thing of plasmin. You had to keep your ankles ready. I'm like, what? Ankles? Like, what is going on here? Yeah. So, but anyway.
Wow.
Yeah. The next one here, our cat's excited. He came into the room to hear it. Elbow macaroni.
Nice.
Yeah. Foodtimeline.org. They talked about elbow macaroni. I like elbow macaroni.
It you know? Is, well... It's, other than penne, it's probably the best noodle for mac and cheese.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they called it macaroni. Which was flair back in the day.
Flair?
Yeah, it was like pompous, like big flair, like on a hat. You would put macaroni on your hat. Yeah, and you called it macaroni.
Yeah.
And it was like flair. Yeah, it was like you're being fancy. Yeah.
I just think that's wasteful.
I think it is.
They could have eaten it.
Yeah, good point. So. elbow macaroni, as we Americans know it today, descends from 19th century Italian tubetti and ditali. The earliest American print reference we find for elbow macaroni is 1900. Mueller's Pennsylvania was an early manufacturer. Cremette's, another popular brand, surfaced in 1912. In sum, products with this name were manufactured in America. They were promoted for convenience, reducing cooking time, and economy because they were cheap. Popular home economists supplied recipes in newspaper columns and cooking schools. From this article, it says, Tubetti, factory-made tubes, usually small, both smooth and rigid. They are cooked in soupids or made with legumes. Also known as
soupids.
That's what it says right there. Also known as tubettini, ditali, or ditaletti, thimbles, gnocchetti, diziti, gnocchettini, and corali, or corals, in Puglia and Sicily, denti de vecchia, which is old woman's teeth, denti de cavallo, or horse's teeth, and then would that be gun?
I can't read it. Can you scroll down a bit?
Ganghi? Di vecchia or vecchia?
Yeah,
Ganghi di vecchia. Yeah, old woman's legs. And maglietti. the name literally means little tubes in Puglia, where pasta d'ingegno.
Yeah,
is that what?
I
yeah,
think so.
Was widespread by the beginning of the 1800s. These irregularly shaped, small, curved tubes could be produced with a torchio or with the appropriate dye. And that is from the Encyclopedia of Pasta, Oretta Zanini de Vita, translated by Maureen B. Font. Oh, thanks, Maureen. forward by Carol Field from the University of California Press.
Sorry, Berkeley. I'm for those who can only listen on audio. I'm not laughing at this. I'm laughing at our cats fighting. And it's just really funny because now,
even see it now, the whole time.
Yeah. Now that we have this video,
they're just back there tossing around.
They really want macaroni.
Yeah, yeah.
They're want macaroni. Fighting over who gets the last macaroni.
They're like, you want beef macaroni? What is this? Yeah, but no. Why do they have so many teeth names for?
Because of al dente. You know, to the tooth.
Right. That's they're still wrestling back here.
I'm sorry.
There they go.
I know I'm not being very professional, but
podcast listeners, they are just like, "Oh, what is so funny about macaroni?"
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, there they go.
No, but that's probably why.
Yeah.
Because you know it's supposed to be like chewy to the tooth.
Yeah. Okay.
And yeah, there's probably so many different names because of all the different regions and dialects, areas, cultural things that get associated with macaroni.
With the macaroni.
Because there's like hundreds of pastas.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Crazy amounts. And they're making new ones all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is like totally crazy. You don't hear of like, well, I guess you hear of like new hot dogs, new sausages, right? Different flavors, blends.
I guess.
You know, food is interesting.
Yeah. You know?
Just as interesting as cats running away from each other. Anyway, what they have here from 1900, it says elbow macaroni. That's it.
Nice.
It was a display ad in the Joss B. Cates store, Lebanon Daily News, April 27th, 1900. The foodtimeline.org once again hitting it out of the park here with ice cream sandwiches.
Are you serious? An ice cream sandwich is 122 years old.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Ate so many ice cream sandwiches when I was younger. It's ridiculous. My favorite one was probably like mint chocolate chip ice cream with the little, and then it gets stuck on your fingers and you have to.
Right.
Yeah.
And then
good times.
I don't know if you'd consider it a sandwich. It is a different variation, but we all rise. For the Klondike Choco Taco.
I heard something saying they're bringing it back or it won't be gone for long or something.
Right.
I don't know.
So what I heard was that Salt and Straw is trying to make their own Choco Taco.
Right.
Which, as somebody
who lives in
Oregon. It'll
be released in October.
Yeah. Somebody who lives in Oregon, we kind of just like, you know, middle finger to the rest of the U.S. states. Like,
well, they're in California
and New York.
Florida.
Yeah, and Florida. So they're in other places, but we got it here.
Yep.
How cool would it be if they were just like, yeah, we only sell it in Portland. That's it. You can only get Choco Tacos.
They're a business. They're not going to do that.
Well, maybe, but then it would fit the Portlandia thing of like, in Portland, it's always the 90s.
There's so many other things that fit that, though, so.
True. Yeah.
But aren't they not really getting rid of it?
I don't know. It was basically like they said it was in a memo. They didn't know if it was real. And then now they're saying it's like official. Like, yeah, they're going to try to get, basically they said something about the shipping or the manufacturing. They can't do it. And they said something about how, oh, we might do it in the future. And it's like, oh, are you guys going to pull like a Starbucks where it's like, oh, I guess we can only have pumpkin whatever in the fall. And then out of nowhere, summer comes around and they're like, oh, well, Klondike looks like we're making Choco Tacos again.
Maybe.
You guys are just cashing in on all of us who took Choco Tacos for granted. Let's be honest.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I still remember when they were at Taco Bell. I loved it when they were at Taco Bell.
You know, I'd rather have a Choco Taco than those strawberry shortcake bars. And totally. I love those things.
Yeah.
So for me to say that, that's a big deal.
Well, and Choco Tacos, and I hate to go on this tangent because we've got ice cream sandwiches here, but Choco Tacos, the thing that I liked was like the first half of the taco. It is so good. It's so rigid. It's amazing. And then the last half is like a messy disaster on your hand and everything. But I still loved it. And I don't like messy foods.
No, you don't.
So that's how good it was.
Yeah.
On to ice cream sandwiches.
Which are very good as well.
Which are, yeah, still great. Nobody's discontinuing those, you know.
Hopefully.
Yeah. The history of the ice cream sandwich can be traced to Renaissance-era English trifles and 18th-century charlottes. Rich compositions of sweet cream and biscuits, advances in freezer technology, made ice cream available to many Europeans and Americans by the 18th century. Old favorites were transformed. Victorian-era cooks, chefs, crafted fancy ice cream, molded ice creams with or without cake. They also specialized in cream-filled Victoria's sandwich cakes. Freeze a sandwich cake, and what do you get?
Ice cream sandwiches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ice cream sandwiches, as we Americans know them today, fall into the category of novelties. According to the food historians, ice cream novelties were introduced in the late 19th, early 20th century. These were the treats of the common folk. Cheaply priced items hawked by street vendors in cities, resorts, and fairs. The origin of several popular period ice cream treats, ice cream cones, ice cream sundaes, banana splits, popsicles, are readily claimed by several people and places. Not so the ice cream sandwich. The earliest print references we find for the product name is 1900. Certainly the product could have existed earlier under different names. And then per their 1900, it says here, the ice cream sandwich man who sells quarter-inch layers of alleged ice cream between tiny slabs of water wafers did a big business during the hot spell. His field of operation was within the district inhabited by the Russians, and his push cart was elaborately decorated with signs and Hebrew characters. He made the sandwiches quickly in a tin mold and was kept so busy that he could not make change, but insisted on receiving the actual price for each ice cream sandwich. 1 cent.
Wow.
1 cent. A cent got you an ice cream sandwich. A penny.
I'm not going to lie. I think especially one of the reasons I don't like old time stuff, you know, 1800s, all that, they just said too much.
Yeah.
They could have gotten to the point a lot sooner.
Yeah.
And this is also in that same thing.
That was from the Hot Water Enterprise.
I mean, it's kind of nice to have that description.
Yeah.
If you're not there, but also it's like you could cut out a couple words at
for
least.
For history,
that
Kaylin.
Could just be like the journalism major
right.
in me. But
That's your modern, you know, journalism stuff coming in.
Yeah.
That's all like, we want you to get to the point. First is better. When in reality, these people were like, I'm going to spin and weave you a tale. And it was like, oh, and everybody got excited. And now everybody's
ads
just like,
had like 1500 word essays.
Right. Now we're just like, this is a gender reveal. When's the balloon going to pop?
Yeah.
Like we just, the ice cream sandwich is a new hot weather luxury, which is rapidly coming into downtown favor. An enterprising hokey pokey vendor whose daily station in the John Street is the projector, and his pushcart is constantly surrounded by a jostling, sweltering crowd of patrons, representing all social conditions. Form baker down to boot black and newsboy. The inventor takes a graham wafer, deftly plasters it with ice cream, slaps another wafer on top, and there is your ice cream sandwich. The cost is trifling, ranging from 1 to 3 cents, according to the size and thickness of the thing. But the Mank is simply coining money. Where he eked out a meager revenue before, he has simply tickled the public's fancy for something new. Yeah.
All right.
This person sounds angry that they're selling.
Do you see what, like, I'm saying? They're going too hard.
They are.
And they don't
press,
need to.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. Gary Payton. They're just getting in there.
Gary needs to chill out. Like,
garden of paint. But no, that was from The Ice Cream Sandwich from the New York Telegraph, The Washington Post, August 19th, 1900.
Nice.
And then from one of my favorites, the Logan Sport Daily Reporter in Indiana in 1900. I just want to read the first line here, because as you can see, this is even longer.
Oh my God. It's like three of what you just read. It's like three of them together.
Yeah. There are ham sandwiches and salmon sandwiches and cheese sandwiches and several other kinds of sandwiches. A downtown restaurant advertises 30 varieties. By the latest is the ice cream sandwich. As a new fad, the ice cream sandwich might have made thousands of dollars for its inventor had the novelty been launched by a well-known caterer. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, my gosh.
They just... You know, I think it's because they had nothing better to do.
No. No, they didn't. So. You know, cigarettes were cheap. Beer was cheap. But while you were at work, you were just doing the cigarette stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough out there. It's tough out there.
Yeah.
But yeah, the next one here, going over recent developments for ice cream sandwich making, you have the Chipwich, which was invented in 1977. The freeze-dried space bar ice cream, which was invented in 1989 by U.S. scientists connected with the Smithsonian Institution. Like, that's a bit much. And then American marketers are currently capitalizing on brand recognition and nostalgia with the Nestle Toll House cookies and Oreos making sandwich minis.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you can buy those lot of minis.
Those chocolate chip cookies with the ice cream.
Witch. Yeah, Chipwich. I like the ones with the M&Ms on them. Those are good. I like those. I don't know why. There's like a little
spot, and I'm not even
a huge fan of M&Ms.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. But the next one here off of foodtimeline.org. Oh, yeah, there's the Chipwich, baby.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Look at the Chipwich cheating for dessert. No. Yeah. And then, you've got Victorian traditions startled by American technology in the 1900s from Food Timeline. We're going over companies that had begun in 1900. My cat, he's trying to go over the whole desk that was created just this year. Oh, he just fell.
I was about to say he's there camera he shy, but...
Yeah, he's wandering. He's getting... Oh, he's checking the bush.
Hate to see you go. Okay. Love to watch you leave.
Right. Yep. But yeah, in 1900, new foods from the U.S. included Wesson oil. So your canola oils, vegetable oil, what have you. Then you had Hershey bars. You had Hills Brothers coffee. Look at that old Hershey's.
I don't think they should have changed the label. No. I love that.
Yeah, just little girls like, I got a Hershey.
I just like the font and the colors.
Oh, yeah, the font.
I love it.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Pretty good. And then your Hills Brothers coffee, which had what looks to be somebody from...
Is that a person?
It looks like somebody that's in, like, their 90 or something.
Oh.
Or it's somebody who's of Middle Eastern descent. I can't tell from the picture itself. He's got a beard. He's got a beard.
Oh.
I know that. So it might be like trying to say Arabica, right? Or Arabica coffee type of thing. But yeah, they were all advertised January 7th, 1900. Then you've got the Enterprising Cookbook, and they started having Jell-O recipes.
Hmm.
That's right. You've got on here, basically there was a lot of convenience foods. So it says during the early decades of the 20th century, American foods reflected the great diversity of people living in our country. What people ate depended primarily upon who they were, ethnic heritage, religious traditions, where they lived. So regional food preferences, New Orleans Creole, New England, founding father, that's what it says there, and how much money they had. So wealthy railroad tycoon or immigrant street peddler. Food manufacturers flooded our markets with new convenience foods, such as Jell-O.
But that's not from...
No, the picture is not... But no, Jell-O actually was created before 1900. Yeah.
Wow.
It just gained popularity because it was convenience foods.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. The next one here, you got Navy Bean Soup, baby! Mm.
That looks good.
Yeah, Yeah, navy bean soup, man. I've had it a couple times.
I don't think I've ever had it.
Yeah. So,
but navy, I love yeah. soup. Sorry, right. just gotta throw right. it out there.
Yeah,
love
yeah.
soup.
And you can see it's got the onions, the carrots, mm-hmm. and you got two little leaves of parsley.
It looks really good.
Yeah, it's a good hearty. Soup. Yeah, your beans.
Yeah.
More you eat, the more you're gonna be good, right? Anyway, the legume, beans, peas, soups, and pottage have been filling empty bellies from ancient times forwards. Nutritious, economical, portable, and forgiving, these dishes grace both kingly feasts and humble peasant tables. Recipes varied according to place and taste. I almost said in time, because we're in a plate in time. Get it?
It's all connected.
It is. Wealthier people added meat, so typically pork, ham, bacon, and spices. Local vegetables rounded out the meal, so beans and peas were easily dried and readily transported, making them proteins of choice for military rations, explorer fare, and starvation sustenance. Yay.
Cool.
Yeah. One of the most well-known recipes in the genre is peas porridge, aka peas pottage. New England baked beans was another popular early American combination. It does say here about the navy bean soup. Bean soups are ancient. That's the exact phrase. They're ancient.
Yeah. They're so old.
Yeah, they're so old. American bean soups made with specifically navy beans surfaced in the mid-19th century. The earliest print American reference we have for a recipe titled Navy Bean Soup was in the Dubuque Daily Herald, October 6th, 1900. They said, "It is easy to imagine these old, weather-beaten sailors strolling along the wharfs of Albany, relating their naval adventures, and how they fought with Farragut at the Battle of Mobile Bay, and how they swapped their navy bean soup for the luscious fruits of the Indies."
I wonder why it's called navy bean.
Well, the sailors, right? Sailors ate it a lot. You could carry beans with you, right?
Yeah, okay.
They traveled well. They dried. Then the next one here, not to be outdone by Oysters Rockefeller, you had Oysters Kirkpatrick. Yes, and it came from the Morristown Cookbook. That was another thing that came up. But yeah, Oysters Kirkpatrick, which, believe it or not, if you try to find a picture of Oysters Kirkpatrick, you'll get Kilpatrick or Kiltpatrick. So I couldn't tell which ones were which, to be honest.
I've never heard of this.
Yeah, I've never heard of it either. I was like, there's another oysters whatever. Like, I've never heard of that. Modern food historians generally agree the dish called Oysters Kirkpatrick was first served in San Francisco's Palace Hotel in the second decade of the 20th century. Of course, most dishes are not invented. They descend from a long line of related recipes. They range from traditional fare, angels on horseback, to spicy selections, so deviled oysters. Oysters Kirkpatrick fall neatly between the two extremes. And per a 1934 article, it says, "This secret was divulged to us by Chef Theodore Hole of the University Club, and is it about the best ever. Make a sauce using two-thirds as much chili sauce as a horseradish. Place the oysters in the half shell, pour the sauce over them, and a strip of bacon over each. Bake in the oven until the edges of the oysters curl." So pretty good. Bacon, oysters, and a spicy sauce.
Hmm.
I could go for that.
Yeah.
And then obviously, like I said, the Morristown Cookbook, great cover. I mean, this, I want to be this guy. He's got a mustache.
Yeah, that could be you.
Yeah, he's got cool little, like, he's got socks over his calves.
His mustache is like,
oh yeah, it's
half
it's,
the size
it's
of
out
him.
There. It's out there.
Yeah.
Even like Biscuit, he's looking at it right now. Yeah. And he's like, "Oh, I'm so jealous. That is such a cool mustache. Mine just blends in with my mouth." But yeah, they had other things here, like looking at basically the, oh yeah, here we go. Yeah, the Morristown Cookbook, what we've got in here, they had stuff for dentists. They had ads on the left side of the page and then recipes on the right.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So there's like okra soup, creamed lobster, salmon timbales, pickled oysters. You had oyster salad, minced oysters on toast, all sorts of things. I mean, you talk about a good set of foods. That was it. That was the place to go. The next one here You've got good old Canadiana.ca. So basically, this one here, you had My Pet Recipes. So they were tried and true recipes for the folks in Canada. Basically, what you've got here is they have rhymes to remember so that you can basically use measurements correctly.
Nice.
Yeah, and then they just have soup. And it's just a ton of words.
That's right. So you have
brown stock, all sorts of stuff.
This is for pets?
No, it's My Pet Recipes. So it's technically like quick recipes you know how to make. They're like your pets. They're always around.
I don't care for that. Yeah, I do. I'm 8 inches away.
Anyways, Cornell.edu has the food for the sick. Yep, and food for the baby. Food for the baby, food for the sick, how to prepare it.
Well, you know what? At least they think about
these
situations.
They even thought about alcoholism.
Oh.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
They thought about alcoholism just for everybody else. But yeah, those were the cookbooks of the time. That was the food of the time. What do you think? 1900.
Well, there was way more
than you thought
that happened that year than I thought. Mm-hmm.
1900, kids. 1900.
I didn't know Jell-O was
so big.
Yeah, I thought that happened later.
Right. Like the 50s.
At least the 30s or 40s, right, or something, because, you know, it was huge, 50s, 60s, 70s.
Yeah.
I also didn't know about Hershey's.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just, yeah.
It was a good time.
It's interesting.
Yeah. And next time on A Plate in Time, we've got 1991.
Ooh, you were one.
I was 1 year old. I was running around in my little baby overalls. Like,
you've just grown with the overalls. Right.
You still have
them right now.
Right. They grew with me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
That'll be a fun time.
Yeah.
So we will see everybody next time on A Plate in Time 1991. Thank you, Kaylee. Joining me. And the cats. Thanks for joining.
Yeah. They added a lot of side entertainment.
Yeah. So. Yeah. But we will see everybody next time. Goodbye.
Bye.
This episode of Culinary Convo was written, produced, edited, and created by yours truly, Devin Rehm, and is a part of Mouthful Productions. Please check us out on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook at Culinary Convo, and our website, culinaryconvo.com, for recipes, episodes, resources, and send an email to culinaryconvopod@gmail.com with your fan suggestions or recipe submissions. You can also support the podcast by going to anchor.fm/culinaryconvo1/support so we can purchase cooking or audio equipment to help create a better podcast, or by using the funds to help further the exploration of Culinary Convo by ordering subscription boxes, food kits, or ordering food products to review. So shout out to our first supporter, Convonaut Dylan. Thank you. I also want to give audio credit to Soundtrap for our intro, transitions, and outro music. Thank you.